and welcome to The Bunker, your need to know on news and politics 7 days a week. I'm Roz Taylor. I'm the kind of person who's always catastrophizing. My expectation is that the worst will happen and that there's no reason why I should be spared it. But most of us aren't like that. We prefer to assume that there isn't going to be another big pandemic in our lifetimes, or that the sea won't rise high enough to affect our homes. Jeff Slagermalch is director of the National Center for Disaster Preparedness at Columbia University, so he spends an awful lot of time thinking about this. Welcome to The Bunker, Jeff.
Thank you for having me.
Cutting to the chase, what disasters are you most worried about in the next decade?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's one that I get all the time. And of course, the disasters we think about are these very photogenic, very televised storms, flooding events, things that really sort of rock us. But the ones that I and a lot of my colleagues worry about the most are actually these slower creeping disasters, drought, a buildup of extreme heat and extreme humidity, these types of things that sort of creep up slowly and start to affect crop cycles and food security and have cascading impacts over where we can live and even the stability of governments that can cascade into broader infrastructure failures, civil society failures, and things like that, that are sort of creeping up on us while we're paying a lot of attention to, just as importantly, these very large, very acute disasters like the storms, the floods, the earthquakes, and things like that.
We've got used to hearing about wildfires and obviously storm damage and things like that in the US, but you're more worried really about the potential for drought. Where is that most acute in the US?
Well, I think we have it throughout the world. And in the US, of course, we obviously have it in the middle parts of the country where a lot of the food supply is grown. But then we look at areas across the world like the Sahel in Africa and the Middle East, where we have heat and humidity, where we can see potentially within our lifetime and certainly over the next 100 years, parts of the world that are virtually unlivable without significant infrastructure. And similarly with crop failures, we've already seen issues of famine unrelated to climate change. And now we see some evidence that suggests it could be a contributing factor to state instability and conflict and things like that. And as these conditions grow more and more acute, then we can see them be even more destabilizing. But even aside from that, when you have entire communities who are built around agriculture or farming or any type of industry that is disrupted, that erodes over time, you also see impacts to the health of the community, the physical health, the mental health, as it all relates to the economic health. So these changes are, I like to think of I don't know if you've heard the expression of boiling a frog, and that if you put a frog in a pot of boiling water, it'll jump right out. But if you put it in at room temperature and slowly turn up the temperature, eventually you'll cook the frog and it'll never even know what's happening. And that's sort of what we're seeing with these slower moving disasters is we're the frog in this scenario.
So we know about the climate emergency, whether we want to hear it or not. In your book, you write quite a bit about disasters that seemed to come out of the blue, but actually there were warnings that they would happen. What sort of things did you have in mind?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. In the disaster space, there are these patterns that you see all the time. And so we don't know exactly when the next wildfire is going to occur, but we know we're going to see more of them. And we know the areas where we're more likely to see them. Similarly, with catastrophic storms and coastal storms and tropical cyclones, we don't know how many there are going to be next year. We don't know exactly where they're going to hit, but we know that we're going to see them hit with more intensity. And I think the COVID-19 pandemic is a perfect example. Is a lot of folks, you know, will say, we couldn't have seen this coming. And in fact, if we look at just the last 100 years, and even with hundreds of years beyond that, the arc of human history is punctuated with pandemics. And just based on rough timing between these pandemics, we were due to get hit.
And you also said that 9/11 could perhaps have been predicted.
Well, so 9/11, looking retrospectively at the intelligence, was predicted. It was just missed. So there were reports of pilots of suspicious backgrounds who were in training schools, but it was lost sort of in the shuffle of intelligence. There were a lot of concerns about increases in anti-US terrorist activity and things like that. So the warning signs were there, just as they were there in terms of some of the impacts we would have from COVID, and it just sort of gets lost. So again, another example of when folks say we never could have seen this coming, that statement's only true if you don't look at the data.
And why do these warnings not get picked up? What are the systemic reasons why people ignore them or overlook them?
Yeah, there's a few different reasons for this. And one, I'll be the first to admit, is that there's a lot of noise and it looks a lot like signal. I spent some time as an epidemiologist and, you know, you see outbreaks every day that are happening around the world that are getting reported. And when I first started looking at these, I thought, oh my God, we're all going to die by next Tuesday. And then I realized those reports coming in every week. And so how do you start to differentiate between things to keep an eye on and things not to keep an eye on? So the task at hand is a lot harder than folks like myself will make it out to be in quick talking points. But that being said, too, we're also really acutely attuned to the immediacy. So the pandemic risk has always been there, but then we're dealing with job losses before the next election cycle, with a sputtering economy, with inflation, sort of keeping the lights on of addressing the issues in front of us, and having a little bit more trouble sort of managing the uncertainty and the threats that we can sort of see taking shape down the road, but aren't yet right before us.
Are we also hardwired to be optimistic? Because I think there's a strange feeling, which I recognize in myself and which is completely irrational, that says, well, I've lived through a pandemic. Surely I won't have to live through another one. Surely it will be it will be beyond my lifetime before something like this happens again. And that makes no sense whatsoever. It's completely irrational. But is it something you see happen quite often?
Absolutely, there is an optimism bias. And we'll look at things and we'll say, well, you know, it's not going to affect me as bad. Or this is why it's different for me and things like that. So we do have sort of these cognitive sort of go-tos that will sort of keep us from being truly objective in certain situations. At the same time, there's also a lot of uncertainty around us and we have different ways of coping with that. We don't actually train ourselves very well to deal with uncertainty. And if you think about it, you know, from the way we're taught science at a very young age, right? It's A, B, C, or D, or it's true or false, but there is a right and a wrong answer. And in reality, when we're talking about using science, when we're talking about understanding disasters and the interaction of complex systems, certainty doesn't exist. We're always dealing with things like rough probabilities and things. And so we default into gut feelings, into optimism.
When there is a disaster, we tend to rely quite heavily on charities, and there will be a big charity appeal. And we trust those charities to get the money to the right place and make a difference. Does that always happen?
I wish I could say yes. And the last thing I want to do is take attention away from charities who are doing really good work. But I think the short answer is that, like with any of the sectors we look at in the book, it's a mixed bag. So on the one hand, you know, most charities are striving to do good work and do good work. But at the end of the day, are they doing the best work that they could do? And I think the answer there is largely no. And the reason for that is that, you know, we think charities, well, okay, they're going to fill in the gap where nobody else will, because they're not bound by politics, they're not bound by shareholders, they're not bound by all of these other sort of flawed incentive structures. But at the end of the day, if you're running a charity, you're still bound by your donors and your donors' preferences. And donors respond based on emotion. It's a very emotional thing. You see this tragic flood on TV and you say, I need to help. And then there's an immediacy. I gave this money. How come I'm not seeing an immediate impact? Now, when we look at disaster recovery, it goes on for decades or more. When we look at preparedness, it's very abstract. But donors and donations and the nature of gathering donations is equally sort of emotionally driven and has these sort of shorter term parameters.
Are you worried about disaster fatigue? I mean, it's a horrible term, but donation fatigue, the feeling that there's just always something terrible going on.
Yeah, I don't worry about it because we're kind of there and it's continuing to get there. I mean, the short answer is that, you know, we're really approaching that breaking point. We can only ask so much of people. And we're even seeing this in some of the backlash where we've had celebrities. I'm thinking, you know, the Maui wildfires in Hawaii, and you had celebrities like Oprah Winfrey and Dwayne Johnson sort of contributing money and then asking people for donations. And there was a backlash saying, look, we're all struggling here. You know, you have all this money. Why don't you just cover the rest of it? And the window for attention is very, very short and getting shorter. And the window for receiving donations is very, very short. So I think we're definitely seeing this. We're maybe seeing some foundations and some other groups standing up, trying to be more strategic and thinking about this, trying to put more robust funding into it. But I think that the industry is at a transition point, and hopefully what will emerge is a more robust business model for 21st century disasters and the pace of disasters that we're seeing. But I think we're very early on in that transition state.
It's obviously not just charities. People rightly expect the state to step up when there's a disaster. Do you worry too that states just can't handle the demands of modern crises, and that maybe on some level some of them don't even want to? I was thinking about this in relation to preppers in the US, people who've clearly lost trust in the ability of the state to help them should there be a disaster, and of just making their own preparations.
The reality is that when we talk about resilience, what we mean is about moving slower and spending more money from the state to build new roads, to increase education, are all sorts of things that are very politically polarizing. But in order to reduce the amount that we need after a disaster occurs, we need to spend more and regulate more to help prevent those disasters from occurring in the first place, and certainly to reduce the damage when it does occur. So there's an unhealthy relationship here where states are failing, nation states across the world, including within the U.S., are failing to meet their obligation to their citizenry, the most sacred element of the social contract of being there for mutual protection. And it's being masked over by transferring that pressure onto charities and pushing for donations and things like that. And so I think that's one of the most important things to unwind. And in developing environments, we see this even more, where you have charities that are essentially providing what are government services and essentially subsidizing failed states. Now, on the flip side, people will die if you don't do it, right? So how do you sort of make that balancing act? I don't have a clear answer for that, other than, you know, we need to step back and really take a hard look at this.
You've got really hard cases like Turkey, for example, haven't you, with the terrible earthquakes they had recently, where a lot of the buildings fell down because they were so badly built. And that was partly because of corruption. And whereas in Japan, when you have earthquakes, that doesn't happen. Frustrations must be enormous.
Yeah, and it's funny you mentioned Turkey. So I was in Turkey just a couple of weeks ago in some of the earthquake affected regions, 8 months after. I've seen a lot of disaster sites, and I haven't seen them all. And there are certainly ones that are far worse that I have not seen. But of the sites that I've visited and of the ones that I've been to, this was the worst. 8 months after, it might as well have been 2 weeks after. The pace of recovery was so slow. Just the level of abandonment of the areas affected, which is a confluence of a lot of different things, including politics and the scale of the disaster and things like that, was really heartbreaking to see. And especially, you know, I guess to put it very succinctly, is that a lot of people were provided with tents, and now those tents were being replaced with containers. So you take a large, vibrant city, you take a municipality sort of at the intersection of a lot of different worlds, and then there's a catastrophic earthquake. And then 8 months later, sort of the most audacious goal was to get everybody out of tents and into these containers, which were about the size of a small shipping container, densely populated areas. You could hear people on the phone two containers away. Kids don't have a place to study. There are no places to socialize 8 months after. And so we think about this. How does this sort of play out over the next decade? How does this play out in the emotional development, the economic development? You have a generation of children who are trapped inside of this. What does this do to them? What does this deny us in the future in terms of these solutions? So to your point exactly, you know, we talk a lot about, you know, how disasters shouldn't be political. Disasters are absolutely political. And our ability to respond to them is driven as much by politics as it is by the infrastructure and the systems dedicated to disaster response that we invest in.
Is there a disaster that a country has actually handled pretty well because it was prepared for it?
Yeah, and you know, I'll actually give an example in the book, Catastrophic Incentives. We give an example, I think it was roughly a magnitude 7.0 earthquake. And there are three examples that we give. One is there was an earthquake in Japan. Can't remember the year. Not very memorable because nothing really happened. It was about a 7.0. The building shook. Tsunami warnings went off, but there was no tsunami. Things went back to normal, minor damage, pretty much back to normal. A fairly, any sort of immediate response was well within the capacity of the systems, things back to normal. We look at the Loma Prieta earthquake in the San Francisco Bay Area in, I believe it was 89. And it was fairly substantial. So there were newer areas that were built up. I was actually living in the area at the time. And a lot of the newly built areas that were built up to the new code were fine, sure, including folks may remember the Embarcadero freeway structure that collapsed. So it ended up being very expensive, very deadly, and very specific areas. Then we look at the same earthquake and we look at it in Haiti, and we look at one of the worst disasters in modern history in terms of lives lost, in terms of economic damage, in terms of and everything that sort of followed with it. Same hazard, but very, very different outcome based on the built environment, based on the political environment, based on a variety of different things. So I think it goes to show that, you know, investment in response systems and investment in preparedness absolutely pay off, but you also have to have the means to do so.
Thanks so much, Jeff. It's been brilliant to talk to you.
Absolutely. Appreciate the conversation.
Jeff Slagomalch and Ellen Carlin are the authors of Catastrophic Incentives, Why Our Approaches to Disasters Keep Falling Short, which is published by Columbia University Press. And if you enjoyed, if that's a word, today's podcast, you can support us to keep making Bunkers for as little as £3 a month. Just search Patreon Bunker Podcast. That way you'll be prepared for the worst. I'm Ros Taylor, and thanks for listening. Hello, I'm Ros Taylor with news of Oh God, What Now?, the politics podcast that's never going to leave its voter ID at home. On Friday's show, it's 6 months until the US election, and Donald Trump is stuck sitting on trial in a New York courthouse. Is he bulletproof, or can Joe Biden turn around the polls? In the second half, it's local elections week, but we've steadily taken power away from local authorities. What if we gave it back? And in the extra bit for supporters, is there a right level of ruthlessness in politics? That's Oh God, What Now? With me, Ros Taylor, Raphael Baer, Hannah Fern, guest Nikki McCann Ramirez, out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
The Bunker was written and presented by Ros Taylor and produced by Eliza Davis Beard. Audio production is from me, Robin Leeburn, and our music's by Kenny Dickinson. Managing editor is Jacob Jarvis, group editor Andrew Harrison, and The Bunker is a Podmasters production.